that it will not equal the gain of a quad. Is that really possible?
Do you have an idea of how many elements we're talking about here, Mel? Is it a two-element Yagi or a ten-element Yagi? Go ahead.
So this is based on, I'm reading on, based on the findings of model quads with Yagi on a 470-centimeter band, over.
You said model. Now I'm a little bit worried. Are we talking about computer modeling, or are we talking about physically making the antennas and measuring them on a real antenna range? Go ahead.
They got a nice picture, in fact. He sent me the picture of even the antenna range with this thing in 2 hours. And they are spaced, let's see. They look like they're spaced with this maybe a couple hundred feet apart. This is up at Pepperdine University. Oh boy, they've got a beautiful view there. It's a beautiful picture, that's true. And you can see one of the quads are up on one tower and the gaggies are up on the other. And he says at the time published Lindsay study was very conclusive. But still people have refused to agree. And the question is subjective even now to computer modeling has in most time produced data that has supported. Now in other words, he did this original. Let's see if I get a reference. When did he do this originally? Oh, you have so much stuff here. Let me read over. In 1960, it was more recent. And supported Lindsay's statement. There you are, Dick, over.
Yeah, it's harder and harder to conquer. To simply dismiss what I should be saying. Okay, we're gonna have to dig a little deeper on this one now. And maybe the whole the jury is coming in on this one. And maybe there's more to it than first meets the eye. My understanding of where effective capture area comes from, and I thought I had a pretty good understanding of it, because most of the experiments I've been running over the last few years on similar subjects, I was able to, with theory that I understand, predict what the results will be, and usually got those results. And to me, effective capture area comes from the resonance phenomena, and the wave itself cannot really see, but I put in quotes the word see, the resonating object. Whether the resonating object be a loop, a triangle, a square, or a dipole. For the most part, that wave cannot see what is resonating. But it is the resonance itself that creates the effective capture area. As I've often stated, if you want an antenna to radiate, you will resonate it first if you want it to radiate efficiently. You can make an antenna that minus 20 dB overrides the tropics if you didn't resonate it. But if you resonate it, you will get out of that single element at least isotropic gain and beyond. And now, if the element is a cubical quad-like element instead of a dipole-like element, does it mean you have that much increase in effective capture area when it truly is still one single resonator, which is more complicated than the way you built it? You can see where I'm going as to why I'm skeptical. But I'm going to read. We'll find out. And maybe I'm wrong on this one. Won't be the first time. And as I said, when somebody's quoting the AP, one of the journals that I respect, all of a sudden I got to find out. The fact that the article stated, or at least the author of your email is stating, that this is controversial, suggesting that other respecters, suppliers of information to the antennas and propagation are questioning the data, and that's what they mean by controversial, I can sort of understand it. Understand how, where we are, where I think we are. But maybe Pepperdine has got something here. I'm going to see if I can get a copy of that issue. sounds like you've already had one mailed to you. I know that the problem is that when I go to the Google search on there, the only place I can get it is the so-called Explore function of the IEEE, and until you pay them the $450, they won't let you open that article. And will I be able to, in the piles of paper in my house, find that particular issue is another interesting question. I know somebody who's got it. I'll eventually get a handle of it, a copy of it. So I guess this is left for next week's discussion, Mel, because we've got to get the hard copy. Do you already have a copy of the article that got mailed to you, Mel? Is that how you got it? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't have the article. These are references. In other words, he's making statements. He's trying to back this up with references. I have a whole bunch of references here. Another one reference here. Here's another reference. Hardy Land, L-A-N-D-S-K-O-V. Hardy Land Stuff. W-7-K-A-R. Was head of the experimental division of the United States Navy antenna system and had available to him the test range for the United owned by the United States Navy. He came up also with the situation of experiments, especially on 20 meters, where he found that the only way that the Aggie that he was testing with could equal design of the quad was that when he made in other words, to bring the Aggie up to the same equal range test, he had to make the Aggie 1.6 times the quad length, according to this. This is this Hardy Land Stuff that he was, I'd say, supposedly United States Navy antenna range expert here in charge of it for 1969, take over.
Okay, that one I don't accept as much. I have spent a substantial amount of time on three Air Force antenna ranges. One of them at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, one of them at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and one of them, the Rome Air Development facility at Newport, New York, close to Utica. I've also spent some time on two Navy antenna ranges. In fact, three. But two of the antenna Navy ranges were fairly poor by my standards. One of them that was located in Pennsylvania, the results were so poor it got closed down. So the fact that somebody made a measurement on a Navy antenna range doesn't mean that the data is fantastically good. And there's even one Air Force antenna range I know about that's not so good. So a military antenna range doesn't necessarily mean it was a great antenna range. They're often set up for the purpose of making an end-to-end test of a particular aircraft and the electronic hardware that's on that aircraft. That's a very different test than trying to make a high accuracy antenna range test of a particular antenna. Usually these Department of Defense antenna ranges are set up for confirming a whole slew of antennas installed performance on an aircraft, which is very different than measuring the performance of the antenna itself. You can take the world's best antenna, and if you do a mediocre job of installing it on that aircraft, you can end up with a very mediocre antenna. Even though the antenna you started off with is fantastic, you put that antenna behind the sheet metal of an aircraft and put a less than perfect radome in front of that antenna, which preserves the aerodynamics of the airplane and still allows the antenna to have a medium amount of transparency, you could end up with a pretty yucky antenna. And so these antenna ranges were just to confirm an end-to-end test of the installation. When you build a radome over an antenna on an aircraft, you're between a rock and a hard place. The main purpose of the radome is to preserve aerodynamic properties. The second motivation for putting a radome there is to give it some amount of transparency to the antenna that's behind the radome. So transparency and antenna performance is secondary. aircraft aerodynamic performance is primary. That comes first. And I've seen some radomes on very respected aircraft that can take an antenna and cut the performance of the antenna that used to be, I'm going to give it the antenna an 80% report card. When the antenna by itself is tested, and you put that antenna behind the particular radome that they were forced to use, and the performance is less than 15%. I've seen it happen. Because again, aerodynamics is more important, rain erosion survival and sleet survival is much more important. You don't want the aircraft to die simply because somebody cares about antenna performance. The aircraft has to survive first. Antenna is secondary. You see where I'm going with it. How back to you, Mel.
Tom, Roger. Well, I'm going to say one more word, and then I'm going to let this go because this is a statement here. Here's one. Really, the final statement. The Quad and Yagi project terminated really in the test made by the West Coast VHF conference in 1980. And it goes on to say that the air, that a test antenna was built for 432. When we made the measurements, originally these measurements were made at the gain of 6.4 dBd. What we did, we replaced the driven dipole with a quad-type full-wave loop. The gain improved almost 10 dBd, and this is measured and substantiatedly created a furor of people scratching their heads at the West Coast VHF conference, Dick. Goodbye.
Wow. If I understand correctly, you had an antenna with 6 1/2 dB over dipole with an ordinary dipole element. You then replaced the driven element with a cubical quad element, leave the rest of the antenna alone, and it jumped up 10. Does that mean it went from 6 1/2 decibels over dipole to 16 1/2 decibels over dipole? 10 decibels improvement just for changing the driven element. If that's what the author is saying, I certainly have to say, wow. If he was telling me 5/10 of a dB, and if he did a very careful measurement, I would sort of believe it. Now that he's telling me 10 decibels, he's telling me that somebody has learned how to slap their hands and fly. Boy, that sounds hard to believe. Back to you, Mel.
No, it's 6.4 dBd, or they changed it over to this quad type full-wave loop, and that's when it went to 10 dBd. And they said that this was definitely all agreed at the West Coast VHF conference, Dick, over.
Yep. And I've got some idea about the way the measurements were made at the West Coast conference. And not necessarily was it done right. There could be substantial measurement error here. Even from 6 to 10, that's approximately a 4 decibel increase by only changing the driven element. What's hard to believe about that one, Mel, is that as you study the way a Yagi works, you'll eventually conclude that your string of directors out in front of the driven element are the skeleton equivalent of a magnifying glass. It takes a certain amount of energy out there in space and focuses that energy onto the driven element, very similar to the way you would take a magnifying glass and focus the sun onto a piece of newspaper and burn a hole in that piece of newspaper. So your director string is a focusing structure. It is a synthesized slow wave structure, which by the phenomena of having a particular velocity profile gives you refractive optics, which, like the objective lens on a telescope, focuses energy on a smaller focal point downrange. Well, that focal point downrange is the driven element. If the original dipole driven element was doing its job, and it was properly impedance matched, it was collecting the energy focused there by the director string. If I now replace that driven element, which was a dipole-like driven element, with a cubical quad-like driven element, and you're telling me your director string out front suddenly gathers more energy, that's hard to believe. So if only the driven element was changed, it sounds crazy. If every one of the elements was changed from dipole to cubical quad, even that sounds crazy, just it's a little bit less crazy. Which were they claiming, Mel, go ahead.
Claiming when they just replaced that element with the quad, that it went from 6.4 to 10 dB. 10 dB, 10 dB. Boy, 10 dB. I'm just reading over here. There's so much reference here. The Lindsay Design Quad, okay, for 6 meters, a four-element quad designed by Lindsay on an 8.5-foot boom. Gain over reference was minus 1.55 dB versus a well-engineered Yagi, and claimed that the gain over the reference on the Yagi was only minus 1.05. without changing the spacing. In other words, physical size of the antenna. This reference was also from the IEEE, something here with J. Apple, A-P-T-E-L-F-L, J-F-P-L-H-P-E-L-Hanson Experiment. You ever hear of this thing?
Absolutely. The Apple-Hanson Yagi-like design. The Apple-Hanson brought over the flat plane of metal, and he built half dipoles. In other words, rather than build the whole dipole and mount him on a boom, he built a whole bunch of what you and I would call monopoles over a flat sheet of metal. Was at least some of the Apple-Hanson designs for Yagi-like elements. And much of the Apple-Hanson designs were done where you were selecting what you thought was the desirable length of a director, and you used a whole lot of them. And in some cases, he modified the spacing between them. In other cases, he kept the spaces constant, and he modified the length. To my knowledge, Apple-Hanson, in that set of experiments, they never really did what I call the optimized design, where they allowed the element length and the element spacing to go free for optimization. The methodology that they used gave them some data, but it was far from a Yagi anywhere near the quality of the Gunter Hock Yagi. DL6WU has spent much of a lifetime studying the optimized Yagi capability. And so, in my mind, he's way ahead an awful lot of the offers that up until then were writing about Yagi A, B, C, and D, and which one has these good properties and which one has those good properties. What Gunter Hock has done was to take all the world's best designs, scale them to his favorite frequency, 432, put them in his antenna chamber, which was the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany, and he literally qualified all these antennas against each other. That's the way he does a shootout. And I've had quite a few communications with him, and it's very hard to find fault with his methodology. So I would believe Gunter Hock over Apple-Hanson, even though Apple-Hanson was published in the antennas of propagation. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I'm going to let this go with enough of them because here are all kinds of claims about the difference in gains and everything like that, and all kinds of references back and forth. I knew this was going to stop. We'll relike that, rekindle that whole thing about Yagi and Quad. So getting late, I think we'll let it go, Dick, because this can go on and on. I know I'm going to get more emails on this. I'm never going to put this to rest once we open this Pandora's box. You want to go further, or I can get back to rich discussion maybe on neutralization, because it gets kind of late to go.
Yeah,
Yes, that's the right thing to do. Let me let it drop. That's the right thing to do. But when it comes to various respected officers, Ms. Vicki is another one. Ms. Vicki of the National Bureau of Standards of the United States worked there for many years, did a whole bunch of backyard yagi experiments, and was going to publish an article on the subject. And he and his immediate superior got into some very strong disagreements with each other, and in response, Ms. Vicki just threw all that data in a drawer at his desk at the NDS. Somebody at a later time yanked all this material out of the drawer. I'm not sure if it was because Ms. Vicki died or went to another organization or what. But eventually the material got yanked out of the drawer and published as an IEEE, as a lab report from the National Bureau of Standards. And so there you would think is an extremely respected source of material. Our National Bureau of Standards, Boulder, Colorado, publishes a technical report on the subject of Ms. Vicki's Yagi optimization, which he did on his own time, not as a government-funded project. And the Ms. Vicki material is good. It's not excellent. The Apple Hansen material is good, but not excellent. These are opinions. The Gunter Hunt material, damn close to excellent. And so, does the Lindsay material fall into that category? Well, let's find out. I don't think controversy is there, though. Yeah, if we dwell on it hour after hour, Sunday after Sunday, of course we're gonna lose a lot of people. But once in a while, a little bit of controversy on arguably one of the most important antenna types. There's approximately 5,000 kinds of antennas. And when it comes to which antenna is most important, near the top of the list are parabolic dishes. Near the top of the list are Yagi antennas. Each of those, properly used, give you a lot of bang for the dollar. So the fact that there's controversy on each of them, on effective capture area, potential gain performance, side lobe level, front-to-back ratios, and all this jazz. The fact that there's controversy on those two very important antenna types is predictable. And to discuss it is reasonable, as long as we don't take it too far each individual time. So I think we should, we'll drop it for now, but we should go back to it after we find out what Lindsay has to say. So I don't think it's bad. I think it's good. Let's see what Rich would like to discuss a little bit further about his neutralization. I know you have some further words on this, Rich, and I hope we haven't put you to sleep. And to Echo Oscar, K2LIW.
Okay,
K2LIW,
and to losing my voice, but I went on the website and looked at the AL-1200 amplifier, which uses neutralization, same as my amp, but uses a tube with higher electrode capacitance, uses a PCX-1200, and what they've done is they've used a transformer, I don't know if it's a toroid or what, they use a little transformer from the cathode circuit, and they use a metal sticky up with an insulator to grab a little capacitance and replace it. Now, am I doing something like that? Am I in danger of wiping out those 8877s, which are plastic sticks? And I'm wondering how this can be done. Bring it into neutralization using what they did on the PCX-1200 using my analyzer. Dancing?
Very fine, Rich. What you described sounds to me like a generic, very typical kind of neutralization network. And neutralization networks for a grounded grid are a little bit different than the neutralization for a ground cathode type of amplifier. But still, neutralization usually does benefit. I think you're asking, can the neutralization circuit, properly implemented, can it do damage to the tube? I think almost zero possibility of that, when properly implemented. Now, if you make some big goof, and so that little piece of metal that's sampling the signal to the plate circuit is an arc over to the plate, couples tremendous amounts of voltage or RF into the cathode. Can it do damage? It's possible. So be a little bit on the careful side. But when it comes to what kind of voltage sustaining, how close a gap you can get away with, I think your common sense will lead you correctly on that one, Rich. Neutralization in general, within reason, is not dangerous. It's not like, taking a circuit that's meant intended for 12 volts and putting 120 volts on it. Of course, you're asking for a lot of trouble. Neutralization doesn't fall into that category. Neutralization is a gentle kind of feedback which partially or completely cancels the undesired feedback path that is already within the tube. That's what neutralization really means. And in most cases, you adjust neutralization by setting up the proper network, feeding not applying the B+, not applying the B+ to the tube, apply a reasonably strong signal to the plate circuit, and with the right kind of monitoring the circuit, find out how much appears at the input. So you apply a signal to the output. You feed a signal backwards, literally, through the tube. With the filament turned on, everything running except the plate voltage. You feed a signal backwards and measure how much gets to the input network. And when neutralization is properly adjusted, nothing gets there. And that's exactly what neutralization is supposed to do. Your amplifier in the forward path is making a whopping big signal. If any of that signal from the output circuit wends its way back to the input circuit, you have a potential oscillator or at least partial instability. And that circuit by which it can get from the output back to the input is through the inter-electrode capacitances of the tube itself. Even though your box around the plate circuit and your box around the cathode circuit are perfectly shielded. So through the tube itself, you've got a feedback path. And if you can feed a signal into that feedback path without the tube operating because you applied this neutralization network, but no B+, if you can make the feedback path go to zero, that's what neutralization is, then you've arrived. So I don't think it's dangerous. I think it's going to be a very educational process, and I think you should go through with it. N2EO, E2LIW.
I'm going to
comment on it, Bill. Stand by a minute, Rich. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let's understand something first about the tube, because I've had experience, not particularly with the 1200, but of the other similar tubes to it. The tube, basically, if you look at it, the plate to cathode, capacitance is small in the tube as compared to the plate to grid or the grid to cathode capacitance. So what happens, so instead of putting in inductance, okay, so in practical cases, the value of the inductance that you have to apply in many cases basically, as according to IMAC, when I questioned this, they said in many cases that the lead inductance and a grid-to-ground impedance can be closely named, closely adjusted by even a small bias-type bypass capacitor. In other words, IMAC, in originally designed for this, they used the lead inductance to cancel the possibilities of oscillation at the lower frequencies, according to what I had communications with them. Like I say, got to remember to say the two cathode capacitance in the tube is the smallest as compared to the plate grid or the grid to the cathode. So they claim in many cases that all you needed was the lead inductance to take over.
Yeah. In the case of the grounded grid, you're way ahead of the game, Rich, for two reasons. One, the game's a little bit lower, but still, the control grid acts as a pretty darn good Faraday shield between your cathode input circuit and your plate output circuit. So, as such, the total amount of feedback mechanism, plate to cathode capacitance, is so darn small that your neutralization network needs to cancel very little signal. It's a fairly gentle circuit. So such a gentle circuit, feeding back just a small amount of signal, in order to neutralize what's going on in the tube, is far from detrimental. You've got to be a little bit careful not to overdo it. You over-neutralize, making your feedback signal too big, and yeah, you can create instability if you overdo it. Be careful you don't fall into the American trap. You go to a doctor and he recommends you take a little bit of this medication, and people make the conclusion that if a little bit is good, more is better. We've all heard stories of people who are assigned to take a certain amount of medication, and they double and triple the dose because they want to get cured faster. And that can be extremely dangerous. Well, the same thing happens with neutralization. Because a little bit is good, don't make the mistake of thinking more is better. If you're following someone's recommendation and they only want a tenth of a feedback capacitance, certainly don't make it 10 picofarads when they call for one tenth. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay,
take N2EO.
You have probably is a fraction of a picofarad. I looked at the picture of what they're doing. They've got a metal tab on a feed to insulator, picking up a few inches away from the tube, and that goes to that transformer, and on the input side, to the Q-cell. Should I get the same size TAM from Ameritron? Should I use a smaller TAM to start with? Would I mount the TAM equidistant between the two tubes, or the header? And
as far as hitting a single bank, are we talking about using a couple of watts? Or are we talking about a signal generator and monitoring the grid circuit through like RF voltage?
You said grid circuit,
I think you mean input circuit. You've got a cathode driven ground and grid amplifier to my knowledge. So you're going to be applying a signal to the output, monitoring the input. If your input monitoring circuit has high enough sensitivity, like say for instance a ham radio receiver, then a signal generator can easily do it. If your monitoring circuit on the input happens to be a crystal diode detector, then yeah, you're going to need a watt. So my guess is that your neutralization adjustment, when properly done, is going to have something in the vicinity of 30 decibels of attenuation. So if you started off with a 0 dB signal generator on the plate circuit, and if on the grid circuit you measure minus 30 or minus 40 dBm, you're there. You're neutralized. Maybe not perfectly, but you're well into the ballpark of neutralization. And for you to measure a input circuit signal of minus 30 or minus 40, if you're using something as sensitive as your ham receiver or a spectrum analyzer, that level is easy. To measure a minus 40 dBm signal with a crystal detector is difficult. Now back to you, Rich.
WB2HWW in the comments.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but give it a go, Howie.
Well, what he could do is use his MFJ as a signal source and use a receiver. That's how I would do it. The MFJ will put out about minus 5 dBm, minus 2 dBm, and then uses a short wave receiver.
That's a good
idea. And by the way, I meant input circuit, cathode input. I erroneously said good circuit.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I knew what you meant. So, I think you know what you're up against here. And now that you know the magnitude, so you're looking for 30 or 40 dB of insertion loss during the neutralization procedure. And when you get to the 30 or 40 dB point, you're well into the ballpark of neutralization. You may not be exactly at home plate, but you're so far into the park, you're going to get 98% of the benefit. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. Should I do this from the highest frequency, which is 10 meters?
Yes. If neutralization is required at all, it's going to be more required at 10 meters than 80 meters. Start off on 10. If you're super lucky with a well-designed neutralization circuit, it'll be perfect at 10 and still pretty darn good at 80 meters. If not, you may have to get a little bit more elaborate, where as you adjust the range switch between the bands, you have to make some kind of a minor change to the neutralization. Use another wafer of the Wayne system, so to speak. I hope you don't have to go there. I think you will not. But the highest frequency is where it's most required. Back to you, Rich.
I have another comment, Dick, a pretty important one.
Yeah, go ahead,
And when you use those MFJ boxes, the cable, get the boxes far away from the receiver as possible. They tend to leak. They're not totally RF.
Yeah, that makes quite a bit. That makes quite a bit of sense. That if your instrumentation has leakage, the measurement becomes more difficult. When in doubt, you can always use the so-called New England technique. Back in the days when you were using a Boonton signal generator, and although the dial goes down to minus 120 dBm, when you're down below minus 105 or minus 110, the leakage through the cabinet crawling into your receiver by bypassing your attenuator on the front panel was a stronger signal, and you got some pretty spooky results. And what the guys in New England invented was the New England technique. By way of inverse square law, you locate the signal generator in the backyard, you feed it with a great big long piece of RGA cable into the laboratory. Now, although the cabinet is leaking, the signal when it goes that far is damn weak, and only the signal going through the attenuator on the front panel and coming down the cable really gets to the receiver, and now you can really measure the receiver's sensitivity. Yes, you've got to calibrate the insertion of the cable, but at least you're back in operation. So, with MFJ, you may have to use the New England technique. Back to you, Rich.
Been there and done that, Dick.
There you go.
How are you doing, slow taking? How is that? Because this is a point. Quarter forward to that track. Yeah, I can hook the receiver to the input, turn the amp on without T-plus, put the MFJ unit into the output. I think everything, that sort of
crosswind
is everything.
You said it backwards. When you're doing neutralization, you're best off to feed the signal backwards. Feed the signal into the output, measure what's at the input. I know it's backwards from common sense, but feeding the signal backwards gives you a more accurate neutralization, in my mind, than feeding it forward. In the case of a triode grounded grid amplifier, you probably will get away with it. In the case of a tetrode tube, the forward circuit, even though the B-plus mic is not there, it still gives you some gain, and it'll confuse the hell out of you. So when in doubt, feed the signal backwards when you're doing neutralization. Back to you, Rich.
I'm at Tech 8-1.
Go ahead, Mel.
See, there's where the understanding comes in. You gotta understand neutralization is basically the feeding of the out-of-phase energy. That basically you're going from the plate circuit back towards the filament circuit. So there's where, like you just said, I was just gonna bring up that point, Dick. You're correct. Because the neutralization requiring an out-of-phase energy over.
I understand. Maybe I said it with. By the way, it's a triode.
I'm well aware that it's a triode. And in order for everything to be in the right physical position, you need the thermal expansion that takes place when the filament voltage is present. As such, with filament voltage present, if you drove the cathode hard enough during a neutralization procedure, the cathode would be doing emitting between cathode and grid, and therefore a amplification-like signal would take place in the forward direction, and it could confuse the hell out of you. So, once again, you're going to have the filament on, B-plus off, and you're going to feed the signal backwards. You know, you said it backwards, but other people heard you and we had to correct you. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, what's the habit I do? I'm not used to the idea of feeding the signal into the plate and looking for an outcome. Looking for output in the input. But I do understand. Point well taken. I will get that transformer. Probably a toroid. I don't know what that is. They use in the scale 1200, and he has the hardware from the Meritron. I guess what I'll do is fiddle with it, probably trim the pair, move the pair back and forth, get it for minimum feedback from output to input.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, stand by a minute. And when you're doing that tuning, some people do it by, you know, twisting a little bit and then making the measurement and closing down the box and so on. If you're really smart, it's nice to be able to monitor your instrumentation while doing a continuous measurement with the cover closed down. You may have to drill a small hole in the cover or in the side of the amplifier. You may have to push it with a great big long industrial-grade cotton swabs, which are a thin dowel that's about an eighth of an inch in diameter, a little bit less, and I guess it's around 8 inches long, by poking your neutralization capacitor in a continuous manner while doing the monitoring from the outside is going to give you the best measurement. And should you make the tab that's picking up the signal and the plate circuit bigger or smaller, that's going to be an experiment. And if your two tubes are running in parallel, in general, they are a co-phase object, and whether you put the neutralization near one or the other, or midway between the two, is a little bit academic. To be super accurate, I would try to put the neutralization pickup capacitor in the plate circuit midway between the two tubes. I would try to do that. But if for mechanical reasons you can't do it, and it's got to be closer to one tube than the other, that's not bad. Because as long as your amplifier is working correctly, those two tubes have the exact same voltage at the exact same period of time. Once you get around to really doing it with these recommendations, I think you're going to find it's not as difficult as with Anchorage. Back to you first.
Okay, well, I thank everybody very much. I'll get those parts from the Meritron. They're a little slow. They take maybe a week, and they'll ship them. It's certainly not a consistent problem, just a few dollars. There's enough room in there to play, Dick. Fortunately, there's plenty of room in there. So thank you. P2RIW, TechNet, thank you, Mel, thank you, Dick. And Howard, you came up with some good ideas. And Julio.
That reminds me of my own Kenwood, the 2-meter all-mode rig. Can't think of the model of that. Had one of those trap doors in the top, which you can open up and look inside. And as WB2ZIT used to say, you put on your hard hat and your safety goggles, you put your ladder in there, and you climb down inside and you fix it. Sounds like you do that if you're a Meritron. Howie, go ahead with your comment.
I want to think is that, you know, a lot of hams, including Rich, have a hard idea and a concept to feed signals at the out, you know, at the output back to the input. A lot of hams haven't had, you know, familiarity with eight parameters or S parameters where you take readings, you know, when you short terminals, open terminals, for signals.
Yeah. The shorting and opening with the so-called hybrid parameters, which are now no longer as respected. The main thing about the S parameters is that during those measurements, all the terminals of the device of the test are terminated with 50.0 ohm resistors. That's the magic of the S parameters. A little more difficult in some cases to do, and the data a little bit more difficult to process, but at least you've got a stable network. The S parameters became popular as the world started inventing higher and higher transistors, because the problem was beta test, for instance, is what current gains you get when you feed a signal at the input and the output is short-circuited. That's the definition of beta gain of a transistor. Well, you take a modern-day high-frequency transistor and you short the output, and the whole thing turns into an oscillator. You can't make the measurement. So S parameters have got a lot going for them. Okay. Mel? Okay, we're getting reasonably close to the bewitching hour. As to whether or not we go to any others or stop right here, the choice is yours. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the only question I always will tell you with doing any of these experiments is when you take the plate voltage off, you got the filament on, and and be careful always, of course, and if you're going to put any driving signal into the tube, because you got to remember, you will overheat the tube. The elements will be damaged because, you know, if you put enough expectation in for it, apply to any grounded grid, usually the less the light bulb is on, you can, you know, damage the tube, Dick. So that's the only caution, you know, is that the grid will have to dissipate all the driving signal over.
Yeah, rather good point. And that is, in normal grounded grid service, your signal you apply to the cathode might drive the cathode into, I'm going to pick a number, peak current of 3/4 of an ampere. At 3/4 of an ampere, leaving the cathode, going through the grid, and hitting the plate, the D plus on the plate, perfectly all right. Remove the plate voltage so that those electrons don't go roaring through the grid towards the plate, but they can help the cathode in the exact same manner, and there's nothing there to stop them but the grid. And you start pouring 3/4 of an RF ampere into the grid. You'll burn up those wires in probably 1/10 of a second. And after that, your tube, your $400 tube, is a very interesting laboratory curiosity that you can make a lamp out of. But it doesn't have very much use after that. So be careful about driving a grounded grid tube or a grounded base transistor without the B-plus turned on in the output circuit. Those electrons have to go to the right place. You stop them halfway, you're in trouble. Back to you, Rich.
Hey, Dick, well, can you believe it? 8877 is almost $900 per tube, okay? So I will be careful. The grid dissipation is 20 watts per tube, but with the MFJ analyzer, I don't think I have a problem.
Yeah, particularly since you're feeding it backwards. Your Ameritron amplifier, when you drive it full blast, I imagine you might hit numbers like 50 watts. And if you drive the cathode with 50 watts, and the plate isn't there, and therefore only the grid can absorb it, and the grid's only rated to 20 watts, I think you see the kind of trouble you can get into. Okay, let's see what Mel has decided to do. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, just a few more words on this, and I guess we'll call it a night because it's getting towards that time. Yeah, also, you know, even in normal operation, you know, if you see excessive grid current, it's usually a sign that the antenna is undercoupling. In other words, you're not coupling correctly, and you'll see that you're not driving the amplifier. You've got to really heavy couple these amplifiers. Otherwise, you will see excessive grid current. And that's many times, that's what really, I can say, finishes the tube or shortens the life of the tubes considerably. These tubes are great, but they got to be handled correctly, Dick, over.
Yeah, that makes a lot of...
The fire has over-current protection on the grid. If it exceeds 100 mils per tube, it automatically shuts down the... opens the antenna relay and disables the device.
Yeah, good point. What happens when an amplifier is lightly loaded is the plate voltage swing starts becoming very large. And therefore, on each positive half of the drive, when the cathode is cranking out a whole lot of electrons, I got a backwards negative half of the drive, but you know what I mean. When the cathode is turning out a whole lot of electrons, if the plate circuit by the same token at the same time has a large voltage swing, then when that pulse of electrons is coming through the grid, and at that instant the plate is at a low voltage swing, it's almost as bad as not having the B plus turned on. And yes, it'll show up as high grid current. Well, you get the protection circuit in there, sounds like you're in good shape. Okay. This was TechNet number 1153 of the series that began I think it was September 30, 1985, was it? No, 1982. So we're a week or two away from the 25th anniversary of the SIGNET. And so, Mel and I are going to open up a bottle of champagne, a tiny little bottle in his office and a tiny little bottle in my office, and we're going to celebrate on the nearest weekend of September 30. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. And back to you, Mel. K2RIW over to K2KDY.
All right, final words on it. My talk with IMAC at the time, that's what they said. You couple it, if you begin to overcouple, you will see a drop in the output power. But you go to that point. So, this is basically the design. Right now, of course, you get all these nice little built-in protection devices. But that was basically IMAC's design, how to go ahead when you were homebrewing. Remember, I homebrewed the amplifiers from scratch when, in fact, with the 3CX800, there wasn't even a commercial amplifier in amateur radio service on the market at the time. So when I built it, the time, in fact, to encourage amateur radio to to experiment with that tube. They, if you bought one tube with the chimney and the socket, they sold you the second one for half price. And I was so impressed by how this thing worked out. I got somebody else with to use their call letters and names so I could buy a second set. So I got two amplifiers that, one was a homebrew amplifier, one was a built amplifier, but I changed the final circuit over. Okay, with that, I'll say goodnight to all. Thank you very much, as always. I'll try to answer the emails. We'll try to get to them. We'll try to make sense of it all. And as Vic says, we will celebrate. we enjoy it. And for those who do celebrate the Jewish holidays, I want everybody to have a great new year. And hope we can all see you back next Sunday to do it again. 73 for all. This is KKY.
Mel, happy and healthy New Year, WB2HW. I'll also see you, Rich.
Howie, you're back to you.
And, Dick, now, we'll pick it up. Something occurred to me. When I make that measurement, do I do it? What do I do with the flight controller? Run it back and forth? Keep it resonant? Dick?
You resonate. In fact, I guess what you could do is to feed a small amount of signal forward, adjust your tuning and loading controls for a reasonable amount of resonance on the output circuit. Not all ground and grid amplifiers have much tuning on the input, but tune the input also. During the neutralization procedure, it would be very difficult to do if the plate circuit was out of resonance. And I guess it's got to be resonated. Yeah. There we go. I'm reasonably sure that if you adjust the tuning and loading control during the neutralization test to maximize the signal. Now here, it's kind of crazy. With the tuning and loading control, you're going to maximize the signal that's being fed backwards. But with the neutralization control, you're going to eliminate it. At first it sounds like you're fighting each other. But I think it's the best way to do it. I wonder if N2MB, Barry's got an opinion on that. Have you actually done a neutralization procedure, Barry? Okay. I guarantee Mel's done a few of them. So my guess is you did it by resonating everything during the measurement. Is that true, Mel?
Most definitely, yeah. I usually would just, put the thing on, use a very little bit of expectation, everything normal. Zip everything, set it up the way it normally is, and then I can say proceed and with that method. But make sure that, like I say, you've got the band that you're interested in starting your neutralization with the system into a dummy load, a good dummy load, and set everything up, preset everything up, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I think when you actually do it, Rich, you're going to find out it's not as difficult as it sounds. Good luck with that, and we'll be hearing from you in the future.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Sir and Sue. I appreciate the help, and who are you?
Hey,
what's this about?
Yeah, happy and a healthy new year to you and the family. And to Jingles. Oh, gotta always ask you how Jingles is.
Oh, he's doing good, just great, Mel. I go down to the ham shack, he looks at me, and he jumps up into my lap.
Hey, so I have to sing him, see it sitting right here. He likes to listen. And also, yeah, she's always following me around. She follows one or the other around, or waits for us to get into bed at night. Loves the bed. Okay, 73 is all.